there's really no reason why you shouldn't be able to have the guns in the national parks if you're a safe gun owner, if you're following the law.
Congress opens up some parks in Alaska to guns. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 20th of May. Good evening. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, biologists are on the lookout for a destructive invasive species.
It's a voracious predator of shellfish, other crabs of the same size.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Want to break your tobacco addiction? Call the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line at 1-888-842-QUIT. Register for free Quit Line counseling and nicotine replacement patches. The combined counseling and patches increase your chances of quitting for good. Trained quit coaches will help you set a quit date and send you information. Free quit services are available to all Alaskans. This message is from the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line. 1-888-842-7848.
Alaska's congressional delegation has voted to tighten regulations on credit cards and to allow loaded guns in national parks. The credit card reform legislation passed the Senate and House this week and now goes to the president for his signature. From Washington, APRN's Libby Casey reports.
The credit card bill prohibits companies from raising interest rates on existing balances unless a customer falls 2 months behind on minimum payments. It also requires simple contract language and advance notice of interest rate changes. And anyone under the age of 21 would need a parent or guardian to co-sign on a credit card. Senator Mark Begich was a co-sponsor of the bill, which passed the Senate on an overwhelming vote of 90-5 Monday. His spokeswoman, Julie Haskett, says Begich's offices have heard from many Alaskans upset by credit card company practices.
We have had a number of folks calling us in the past 4 months over getting these letters about interest rates going up dramatically for no reason or fees being increased. A lot of calls. We were quite surprised, actually, how many people were giving us a call on that issue. So it seemed like one small thing we can do to make people's lives easier, which is fix these predatory practices and these arbitrary rates that they're imposing.
The credit card bill also included an amendment that would let visitors to national parks carry loaded guns as long as they abide by local state rules. It garnered the support not only of Republicans, but 27 Senate Democrats, many from Western states. Haskett says Begich strongly supported it.
There's really no reason why you shouldn't be able to have the guns in the national parks if you're a safe gun owner, if you're following the law.
Gun control advocates say there's no reason people need guns in national parks and blame the National Rifle Association for exerting its influence over Congress. The Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence called the vote reckless. Alaska's Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski and Congressman Don Young supported the Guns in Parks amendment. Young says while it is odd to lump a gun law onto a credit card bill, he voted for it and says he's not surprised to see gun issues are getting a lot of attention these days.
The Senate and the House both recognize that this is, under the Obama administration, this is probably the most watched issue now, because their feeling of this transitional type of government gives the government so much control over everybody's lives every day that people are willing to attack, buy arms, buy ammunition to defend themselves. And I think this is what this is all about.
President Obama is expected to sign the credit card bill with its attached gun amendment by Memorial Day. Guns are already allowed in many of Alaska's national parks through ANILCA, the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, which was enacted nearly 30 years ago. National Park Service spokesman John Quinley in Anchorage.
The largest difference in Alaska is that the great majority of the acres that the National Park Service manages have been open to carrying firearms since those areas were established in 1980 by ANILCA, the Alaska Lands Act. So the large northern parks, Gates of the Arctic, the Noatak, Wrangell St. Elias, those have already been open for carrying firearms in most places in the park.
Quinley says parks older than ANILCA would be affected by the new gun rules if they're signed into law.
Those areas have been closed to carrying firearms, and that would include the old section of Denali, which would be the entrance area and along the wilderness area along the Park Road, portions of Katmai, including Brooks Camp, portions of Glacier Bay, including the Bartlett Cove developed area.
Right before the Bush administration left office, it lifted restrictions on guns in national parks that had been around since the Reagan era. However, that didn't last long because a federal judge blocked the Bush policy just a couple months later. Initially, the Obama administration said the Interior Department would review the policy, but Oklahoma Republican Senator Tom Coburn sidestepped that with his Guns in Parks amendment, which now looks poised to become law. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
Senator Lisa Murkowski has lifted her hold on the president's pick for Deputy Interior Secretary. She and fellow Republican Bob Bennett of Utah were blocking the Senate from voting to confirm David Hayes in the Interior Department's number two job. Murkowski says they dropped the hold today, once Interior Secretary Ken Salazar pledged to fully answer their questions. Bennett is upset about canceled oil and gas lease sales in his home state of Utah, and Murkowski wants answers about the administration's direction on oil and gas issues. Her spokesman on the Senate Energy Committee, Robert Dillon, says Salazar has promised to respond to Murkowski's five-page list of questions.
She had several conversations with Secretary Salazar, both directly and then on the staff level. There were quite a few conversations over the last few days on trying to seek a resolution to this issue that satisfied both Senator Murkowski's concerns about oil and gas policy and the administration's.
Secretary Salazar has said he needs more of his team confirmed so they can help him tackle questions and looming issues. The Senate may confirm Hayes as soon as tomorrow. The Lower Yukon village of Russian Mission is being hit hard by breakup floodwaters. Homes have flooded and the village's massive fuel tank is floating. KYUK's Alice Criswell has more.
Water is overtaking much of Russian Mission. Mayor Sharon Kazevnikov says that homes closest to the river have been inundated. People from about 10 houses were evacuated to homes on higher ground. The downtown sewage lagoon also overflowed. The lagoon serves the school and a handful of homes. Water and sewer workers had time to pump most of the sewage to another lagoon before water began rising. Philip Duffy is the transportation specialist at the Ugagamut Tribal Council.
There was less than 1,000 gallons inside the tank. It was just very buoyant. There was no spills. The storm manager did a good job in preparing for high water.
In the downtown area, residents are riding boats where they usually walk. Outside transportation and mail delivery has halted because the runway is submerged. The village police department and the tank farms are also underwater. Russian Mission is nearly out of fuel. Residents were limited to 5-gallon purchases, even as they prepared for the flood. When floodwaters reached the 17,000-gallon fuel tank, it began floating. Again, Philip Duffy.
Water, the waste up to the other lagoon started flowing into the lagoon. It was almost dry, and a minimal amount has mixed with the floodwater.
Water levels are still rising, but the ice downriver from the village is thinning out. Villages below Russian Mission are currently in a flood warning. Reporting from Bethel, I'm Alice Criswell.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Air Force says goodbye to the F-15.
There are a lot of other countries that are starting to catch up to our F-15s, but they're not anywhere close to the F-22s.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Sooner or later, the H1N1 swine flu will come to Alaska. There are simple ways to avoid catching or spreading this or any virus. Wash your hands often with soap and water or use a waterless hand cleaner. Cough into your sleeve or into a tissue rather than your hands. Stay at home if you're sick and contact your health care provider. More information is available on the state website at pandemicflu.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the state of Alaska.
growing homelessness in Anchorage has prompted the city's Coalition on Homelessness to take urgent action. Recent data indicates that homelessness in the city has almost doubled, and many of those affected are children. Acting Anchorage Mayor Matt Klayman held a press conference today to highlight new efforts by the city administration to address the problem.
In our work with identifying stimulus funds under the Recovery Act, we have approximately $775,000 that's coming for over 2 years to use in a joint agency effort to increase services to the homeless. That'll be one position in the city and then four positions in four different nonprofits that provide different services to the homeless population. And the city position will be very involved in coordinating those services among different agencies.
I understand that homelessness, though, is on the rise in Anchorage. Are there any statistics or data to show us just how much that increase is?
We're showing about a 44% increase since 2007. Some of that is a product of better counting, but even if you make some adjustments for the counting, it's still an upward trend in homelessness, which I think is consistent with some of the challenging economic times.
So how will these stimulus funds be used to provide more services for the homeless? I mean, the very fact that they're homeless indicates to me that they do not have vehicles. It will be difficult for them to get to an office, perhaps, to apply for assistance.
That's a lot of what these services will provide, is trying to identify the homeless and then figure out, because we've got four different nonprofit agencies that are partners, they provide each one provides a somewhat different service. And so part of the effort will be to identify which service would be best suited to serve which individuals.
Are these stimulus funds expected to provide for outreach services that will be ongoing, or will it just be enough to set up the services themselves?
It will fund all five positions for a total of 2 years. And so in the long term, the city will certainly need to make a decision about continuing these efforts.
What are some of the meaningful services? Can you thumbnail some of the ideas the city has?
Some of it is working for the Housing First model. Some of it involves some mobile caseworkers so that you won't have to have the homeless person always come to the caseworker. There'll be an ability for a caseworker to go to the homeless person. The average age of the homeless population in Anchorage is 9 years old, so there's a number of kids that are affected, and we see those kids in the schools. And so some of the services will be trying to address the specific needs of youth and family that are in the homeless population.
And you're saying a lot of children are affected. Now, are these children living in shelters, or are they living in street camps?
I think most of it, you don't have a lot of the children living in the camps, but some of them are in shelters. They typically are not solo. They're usually with parents. So these aren't abandoned. These aren't orphans. These are children in families, and the family doesn't have a home, and so the children hence don't have a home because the family doesn't have a home.
Acting Anchorage Mayor Matt Klayman, he says the disturbing numbers emerge just as the city is dealing with four recent deaths among Anchorage's street population. The homeless population count was conducted by the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation in collaboration with the municipality of Anchorage. Governor Sarah Palin signed a new education bill into law during a brief stop in Petersburg today. From member station KFSK, Alex Hotz has this report.
Governor Palin stopped by Petersburg High School to sign House Bill 215. The bill removes salary scale limitations for hiring new out-of-state teachers. Palin signed the legislation in teacher Jim Engel's American Government class, which was packed with students and faculty eager to see the governor.
You're very blessed to get to live here and to be raised in such a wonderful town like Petersburg. It's a close-knit community. It's beautiful, hardworking, unpretentious people who live here. I have great respect for a community like this. So it's very good to get to be here.
Pass law prevented out-of-state applicants from getting credit for more than 8 years of teaching experience outside of Alaska. Wrangell Republican Peggy Wilson sponsored the new measure, and according to Palin, it will help Alaskan schools be more competitive when they're looking to hire.
Some of our rural communities, it is tough to find people who want to live out in perhaps a village, very, very remote, very expensive to live in. So a hard-to-fill position out there, this applies aptly, and it should help in recruiting people to fill those positions.
Palin also encouraged the students, who were mostly graduating seniors, to return to Alaska once they were done with their higher education.
There is no place else in the world like this state where there are so many opportunities.
In Petersburg, I'm Alex Hotz.
Later in the day, Governor Palin visited Wrangell to sign a boating safety bill. KSTK's Tony Gorman reports.
Thank you so much.
Governor Sarah Palin received a warm welcome Wednesday afternoon during her first visit to Wrangell. Wrangellites crowded Chief Shakes Island at the Wrangell Harbor to witness Palin sign House Bill 151 into legislation. The bill extends the statewide boating safety and education program for another year. The signing comes during National Safe Boating Week, which is used by the U.S. Coast Guard to promote boating safety awareness. Wrangell Representative Peggy Wilson, Mayor Don McConaghy, Wrangell Assembly members, and the U.S. Coast Guard were on hand for the signing.
This program is needed. It is so vital in a state like Alaska, as vast as Alaska, and with so many of our residents so dependent on boats for their transportation and their recreation and their livelihood.
During the ceremony, Palin referred to her commercial fishing days to express the importance of the program.
My husband Todd and I were commercial fishermen in Bristol Bay, and when we talk about boating safety and we're trying to get our kids and other kids to understand the great respect that you have to have for the waters in Alaska, the water is so powerful. And the water will win if you do not do all that you can in terms of being careful.
The Boating and Safety Education Program was created in 2000 in response to the state's high number of boating deaths. Alaska has one of the highest boating fatality rates in the nation. Bill 151, which was sponsored by MATSU Representative Mark Newman, will keep the program running through 2011. The program would have been over if the bill wasn't signed due to a sunset clause from previous legislation.
That would be extremely unfortunate because Alaska would no longer be eligible for the federal funding that allows the program to work, since the boating fatality rate has dropped almost 50%.
Mike Folkers is the recreational boating safety specialist for the 17th Coast Guard District in Juneau. He says the next step is to eliminate the clause from the bill and improve the Coast Guard's Kids Don't Float program.
Children grow up wearing life jackets, and it becomes almost a rite of passage to be able to take that off. You're a man when you don't have to wear your life jacket anymore. But we all know that wearing your life jacket helps save lives. So it's important to be a man and wear a life jacket.
After signing the bill, Palin viewed Tlingit art and culture during a tour of Chief Shake's Tribal House. Then she mingled with Wrangellites taking pictures and signing autographs. Reporting from Wrangell, I'm Tony Gorman.
Construction is getting underway in North Pole on a plant that will turn local waste wood into pellet fuel for heating. The new Alaska company, Superior Pellet Fuels, is backed by private Lower 48 investors. General Manager Chad Shoemaker says work on the 10,000-square-foot pellet plant is just beginning on a lot off the Richardson Highway.
The building is scheduled to be completed sometime in early July. And we will be installing equipment immediately thereafter, expecting to be operational in the month of September.
Shoemaker says processing equipment, including conveyors, dryers, and mills, will be installed to turn waste wood into fuel for pellet stoves and boilers. He says 40-pound bags of pellets will be retailed in local stores for around $5.50 each, making pellets a good option to oil-fired heating.
Basically, what you're looking at is a break-even price in comparison to fuel oil would be at about $2.12 a gallon.
Shoemaker says the pellet plant will initially hire about 10 people, and if demand is there, the facility could double that number. Superior Pellet Fuels is working with local sawmills, state forestry, and the Department of Defense to collect waste wood from timber processing, land clearing, and wildfire mitigation.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP, teaming up with Alaskans since statehood and together looking toward a bright future. And by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
A little piece of aviation history will soon disappear from Alaska's skies. The Air Force is putting its F-15s into retirement. They've been the backbone of the nation's Asian and Pacific defense for 28 years, working from Elmendorf Air Force Base in Anchorage. Air Force Lieutenant Aaron Binbow says they'll be replaced with the new F-22, the next step up in aviation technology. She says the difference is obvious.
Even a civilian that doesn't know anything about them, you can look at an F-15 flying and look at a 22 flying, and you can see the difference. because they have the super cruise and they can go faster and things like that. And really the point in shifting from the F-15s to the F-22s is just so America retains its air superiority against all the other nations, because there are a lot of other countries that are starting to catch up to our F-15s, but they're not anywhere close to the F-22s.
Finbo says the changeover will be completed during 2010. She says there will not be a huge difference in the military's presence or mission in the state because of the upgrade. The State Division of Forestry has laid out a slate of Fairbanks area timber sales to be offered at its annual auction next month. Fairbanks area forester Mark Lee says the 11 sales include spruce, birch, and aspen along the Parks and Richardson highways and the Tananaw River.
It's kind of a cross-section of all different sizes of sales, from smaller firewood sales up to larger firewood sales to sales of white spruce for saw logs. Pretty much a typical sale program.
Lee says the offering represents 4 to 5 million board feet of spruce, much of which goes into lumber and house logs. He says some birch is also turned into lumber, but most, about 6,000 cords worth, is destined for wood stoves and boilers.
That's gone up actually quite a bit, and that's why we do have a few more firewood sales in there, but not dramatically larger than the past.
Lee says firewood sales bring in about $10 a cord, while trees sold for lumber generate about $60 per 1,000 board feet. He says the state hopes to use some of the receipts from timber sales to open new areas to personal use firewood cutting. Any timber sales that don't go during the June 9th auction will be available over the counter. And the Forest Service is questioning visitors and locals using the central and southern parts of the Tongass National Forest. Up to 30 staffers are surveying hikers, cabin users, and others through October, Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Interviews are being conducted at nearly 350 sites in the Wrangell, Petersburg, Ketchikan, Misty Fjords, Craig, and Thorne Bay districts. It's a continuation of a survey that took place in Sitka and Hoonah last year. Mary Beth Nelson of the Sitka Ranger District says staffers are talking to people using campgrounds, trails, roadside stops, and wilderness areas. Nelson says most of those contacted in past surveys were willing to talk.
It kind of depends on the weather more than anything else. If people are wet and cold, then they don't want to stop, which is understandable. But more often than not, people have been very good about being involved in the survey, especially if they understand how the information is going to be used.
The survey includes questions that help officials understand how the Tongass is used, as well as related economic impacts. Compiled reports are submitted to Congress as part of budget deliberations. Nelson says the agency also considers the data at the national and district level.
It's also used in-house by the U.S. Forest Service. We know at the Washington office it's being used to break up the budget between engineering and recreation. And we also know that some of the regional offices are starting to use it for the same purposes, for budget purposes.
The agency began surveying forest users last fall. The summer season means efforts are being stepped up. Some survey sites are alongside roads at rest stops and picnic areas. Others are near trails. Nelson says participation is voluntary.
They approach us. We set up an area and we contact them as they're leaving a site. A lot of the times people see us going in on the trail and then they'll be interviewed on the way out.
Survey sites are chosen by a random generation computer program. Nelson says the information is updated every 5 years. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Sitka.
Volunteers around the state are once again monitoring Alaska waters for European green crab. As KRBD's Deanna Garrison reports, the invasive species has established itself on the east and west coasts and is steadily making its way north.
For the past year and a half, UAF Associate Fisheries Professor Gary Freitag has been loading up a friend's floatplane with monitoring equipment and small crab pots and flying to the southernmost tip of southeast Alaska in search of the crab species. Nicknamed the Roaches of the Sea, Freitag says European green crab feast on clams, shrimp, oysters, mussels, and scallops, as well as other species of small crab.
It's a voracious predator of shellfish, other crabs of the same size, They won't outcompete a Dungeness, but a Dungeness has to go through the size range. So they will compete with a Dungeness and kill Dungeness at the time that they're growing through that size.
Despite its name, Freitag says a European green crab can be red, brown, or green. He says a crab looks like a small Dungeness. Freitag says a crab first appeared on the East Coast in the late 1800s after scientists believe they hitched a ride on visiting European ships.
Well, a lot of ships, they'll come to America empty in order to get supplies and whatever resources we have here. And in order to do that, a lot of times over in Europe, they'll fill their bilges with bilge water. They come across the U.S. Now they want to empty all that bilge water out because they want to fill it with cargo. And they pump all that out into the marine water. And all of a sudden now the plankton are released into this area and they establish colonies.
Freitag says European green crab didn't take off on the West Coast until establishing in San Francisco Bay in 1987. Freitag says no green crab have yet been trapped in Alaska, but he thinks it's only a matter of time before that changes.
The environmental conditions here are even better than San Francisco Bay and down south. In Europe, the temperature regimes of the marine environment are same as here. I mean, they're very, very similar environmental conditions. So they've actually evolved to be perfectly suited for this marine environment.
Freitag expects the first European green crabs will show up in southern southeast Alaska unless some are brought in via boat. In that case, he says Kodiak, Juneau, or Dutch Harbor could be the first areas of Alaska affected. The Smithsonian Environmental Research Center began monitoring for green crab in Alaska in 2000. Since that time, the National Marine Fisheries Service has trained a dozen volunteer monitors statewide. Freitag says a first step in monitoring is determining where to search for the crab.
The idea is to find habitat that is the right habitat.
Once the location is determined, Freitag says monitors set small baited traps for 24 hours. He says non-invasive species that are caught in the trap are recorded and released. Freitag is monitoring two areas this summer, the outer coast of Dahl Island and the southern end of Prince of Wales. Anyone who suspects that they have seen or caught a European green crab is asked to contact the State Department of Fish and Game. In Ketchikan, I'm Deanna Garrison.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Alice Criswell in Bethel, Alex Hoff in Petersburg, Tony Gorman in Wrangell, Dan Ross in Fairbanks, Ed Schoenfeld in Sitka, and Deanna Garrison in Ketchikan. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Fike. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. Our intern is Susanna Caldwell. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Thin Air, with 50 years of flying experience and offering charter service throughout Alaska and the United States. Details online at thinair.com. Comfort Suites Anchorage International Airport. Comfort Suites, an all-suites hotel, is now open with a 24-hour shuttle service, indoor pool, and high-speed internet access. Reservations at 243-8080. And by BP, teaming up with Alaskans since statehood, and together looking toward a bright future.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.